Good evening. Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, the talk show about ideas. Little Atoms is based around ideas of the Enlightenment and actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism, and secular humanism. This means we often end up discussing the antithesis of these ideas, things like superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. I'm Neil Denny. I'm going to hand you over to my colleague, Padre Greedy, who's going to introduce our guest tonight, the return of Mark Vernon to the show.
Good evening. Mark Vernon is a writer, broadcaster, journalist, blogger, and an honorary research fellow at Birkbeck College. He has a PhD in philosophy from Warwick University. Mark was a priest in the Church of England between 1994 and 1996, but quit the church as a conviction atheist. Mark now sees himself as an agnostic. His books include What Not to Say, The Philosophy of Friendship, and After Atheism, Science, Religion, and the Meaning of Life. Mark recently edited the latest edition of Chambers' Dictionary of Belief and Religions. His most recent book is Plato's Podcasts, The Ancient's Guide to Modern Living. So, Mark, would Plato have a podcast?
The idea behind the quip in the title is that Plato wrote dialogues, and this is a common piece of common knowledge, but it's actually often rather overlooked, I think, and there's an awful lot in the fact that he wrote dialogues and not, say, treatises. And we know he didn't write any treatises. It's not just like it didn't get lost. We're pretty confident that we have everything that he did write. And so I think the idea about dialogues is that they're kind of invitations to do philosophy, and you see it kind of happening amongst the characters on the page, as it were. And the idea, I think, for Plato is that philosophy really takes place in people's lives rather than just it on the page, on the word. And the analogy would be that it's perhaps a bit like podcasts today, that in the same way you can listen to a podcast and sort of be get some good ideas going around your head and be invited to respond to them. But the response is really what matters, what you're going to make of them yourself, what risks you're going to take with the ideas, how you're going to see yourself through them. And then I guess the other thing is that the dialogues of Plato went around the Mediterranean, kind of like ripples of knowledge or whatever, these invitations. And again, it's a, you know, the idea is it's a bit like podcasts going across the internet today. So it's a quip, but there's some substance there. And I do actually think the business about Plato writing dialogues is something that is very often overlooked. People often, for example, read The Republic, one of his most famous dialogues, and think this is like a political manifesto. And so Plato's accused of all sorts of things, like being a totalitarian in there. But this is a dialogue where a bunch of people are exploring what justice might be and how you might set up an ideal society. It was never meant as a manifesto. It's in fact, until the 19th century, it was read as a kind of, a bit like Thomas More's Utopia. It was a sort of exploration of the human nature and what happens in politics, you know, rather than being some kind of blueprint. The idea that it was a blueprint would have just been a bit silly. And so, as I say, you know, the fact that he wrote dialogues really counts for a lot, in fact.
Let's look at how there's a chapter in the book about Plato and about what you've just described about the idea of the dialogue. But let's talk about how that leads to the wider theme of the book. I mean, what's the book actually about?
So the idea of the book is to look at a whole bunch of these ancient Greek and Roman philosophers, and not just talk about what they thought, but to try and tell their lives as well, the stories of their lives. And again, until the modern world, these guys were known as much for the stories about their lives. Sometimes we can be sure it's fairly strong history. At other times, it's mythological. But of course, the myths are remembered for reasons, for the message they carry. So the myths are important too. And yeah, it's about this idea that for the ancient Greeks, philosophy was about living. That, you know, the proof of the pudding's in the eating. For the ancient philosophers, the proof of the philosophy was in the living. Whereas I think today, people do tend to think of philosophy as the end product of philosophy is like a good argument, or it's a proof. Or it's a, you know, carefully reasoned position. Now, that matters. You know, anyone who's picked up a bit of ancient Greek philosophy will know that they can do the thinking, but it's the living that really counts. So hence these stories. And they were a very diverse bunch of people. You know, Plato and Aristotle, they did their philosophy together for 20 years, in fact, until Plato died. But nonetheless, Aristotle came up with slightly different ideas. The Epicureans were different again, and the Stoics. And then you got the kind of the anti-philosophers, like the Cynics and the Skeptics, who saw themselves in some way as over and against the traditions which were already beginning to form.
Well, let's dive straight in there then, and then we'll talk about Diogenes, who is the founder of the of the cynic movement. So tell us about him.
So Diogenes the cynic, the things that he's remembered for are things like living in a barrel. He said, why bother going to all the hassle of buying a house when there's just stuff you can drag out from behind the temple and live in a barrel, as he did. He became quite a character in ancient Athens. We know that for sure, but for one reason being that one day his barrel was trashed by a group of louts, and the citizens of Athens clubbed together to buy him another one. So he kind of was rather liked. I think the ancient Greeks were really fascinated by encounters between people that were more or less completely powerless and the very, very powerful. There's lots of stories about philosophers encountering emperors, for example, in the Roman period. And the one that's known about Diogenes is his encounter with Alexander the Great. Alexander was alive for about the same time. And the story goes that one day Alexander came to see Diogenes. And maybe, you know, this man who conquered half the world was rather intrigued by this extreme character who the last thing wanted to do was go out conquering other lands. So the story goes that Alexander comes before Diogenes and says, Diogenes, I can give you anything. And Diogenes looks up at Alexander, standing there, you know, in his armour. And it turns out he's blocking out the sun. He's cast a shadow across Diogenes. And so Diogenes says, well, you can just step to one side. And the story there is, you know, how, I guess for the cynics, everything that's valuable in life is actually available to everybody. You know, the warmth of the sun and all this other stuff that we accrue or that we desire or we long for in life is as much, you know, fluff, really.
The subtitle of your chapter on Diogenes the Cynic is On the Deceptiveness of Fame. And you make illustration, you make a comparison with Paris Hilton.
Another anachronistic leap into the modern world, but again, it's
not
it's
someone
a serious
who comes
point
up on Little Atoms very often.
Because the thing that Diogenes the Cynic and Paris Hilton both have in common is that they were both known for having sex in public. I guess people know the story about Paris Hilton putting out an internet on YouTube. Well, Diogenes was known for masturbating in public. It was not too early in the evening to say that. And again, this is a kind of serious point. What he said was that unless you are free to break conventions, you're not really free at all. You're just living the lives that society tells you to live. And so they were known as the cynics because the cynic doesn't mean the word which it means today. The cynic is comes from the Greek for dog. So they became known as the people that live like dogs. And but again, the idea was, you know, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. So if you've got nothing left to lose, you're free. So hence that story.
You think there's these people, and how kind of, I suppose, of any of the major movements of the cynics or the skeptics or the Epicureans, how, you know, prevalent were these ideas in the way people lived their lives?
That's quite a tricky question, actually, and there's quite a lot of debate about it, because a lot of the ancient philosophers were from a kind of social elite. You probably had to have money, at least to have the leisure time, in order to go to a philosophical school or something like that. That said, they weren't as elite as sometimes it's said. So, for example, Epicurus, certainly, and Plato, too, had women and slaves came to their schools. We also know that Epicureanism and Stoicism became very popular, partly because there's a number of artifacts, things like rings and brooches, which have been found with kind of Epicurean sayings and prompts written on them. And then there's walls that have been unearthed in towns and cities, again with kind of graffiti, Epicurean and Stoic graffiti. So people did turn to them when they were working out how they should live their lives.
And would people have, again, this is probably a point of speculation, but would it have been, would, say, being a follower of a particular philosophy have been as important as, say, worshipping gods?
I think that religion was just a wholly different thing in the ancient world. There was no sense of converting to a religion. A religion was much more about just the place in which you lived. Mm-hmm. And if you lived in a particular place, then you worshipped the gods in that place. And again, worship wasn't, you didn't go to church and sing hymns. You kind of performed the rituals and so on in perhaps, I don't know, in an analogous way that we pay taxes when we live in a local place. Mm-hmm. And that, again, it's not just a kind of a bureaucratic nod. By paying taxes, you know that you belong to a place, you're contributing to the wider society and so on. So again, the rituals to gods would carry a lot of meaning, but there was no sense of converting. So I guess that the philosophy functioned just alongside regular religious practice. And even the philosophers that certainly challenged what people said about the gods, Socrates did, and Epicurus certainly did, they still believed in gods, and most of them still performed the rituals and so on. Epicurus, for example, said, don't fear them, but he didn't say, don't take no notice of them. And Socrates too was well known for performing all the rites that people tended to perform in relation to the gods, although he was charged with introducing new gods into Athens when he died, and that was one of the reasons why he had to drink the hemlock.
Let's have a look at another example, and you've already mentioned Aristotle, and Aristotle was alongside Plato at Plato's school and then set up on his own. But the chapter on Aristotle is subtitled How to Deal with Being Unpopular, so let's look about what Aristotle tells us about that.
Well, there's a really nice little kind of historical accident associated with Aristotle, because Aristotle, he'd spent a lot of his life on the move, actually. He came from quite an influential family in Macedonia, and his father worked for Philip of Macedon, who was the father of Alexander the Great, and then Aristotle was the tutor of Alexander the Great. So he was often associated with rulers, and I guess a close association with rulers often brings trouble, especially when they're overthrown. So he often had to flee cities in order to escape trouble. And he had to flee Athens a couple of times, actually. He wasn't very popular with the democratic crowd, who chased him out of Athens with throwing stones and pot shards and things at him. And there's a rather nice this accident in history is that one time Aristotle was actually honoured by the ancient Greeks, and there was a plaque which they put up in honour of Aristotle for the work he'd done for them. And the reason why this plaque survives is that at some later date it was hurled down a well and destroyed, presumably because Aristotle had become unpopular. So it's rather nice. You can actually see these shards with this old honour, and this is like an artefact of Aristotle's unpopularity.
One of the things that you don't actually cover in the chapter, but what actually became of Aristotle in the end, because a lot of the philosophers do come to quite a sticky end, but considering we're talking about Aristotle having so many enemies, and did he just end up going off into retirement? And
yeah, he retired. He said he didn't want Athens to be guilty of the crime of Socrates again. If they killed Socrates, they didn't want them to do the same thing again. And he retired to an island, which now is quite near to Athens, but then would have been 2 or 3 days' journey. And so he felt he was out on a limb. But the suggestion is that he died relatively contently because he left his will. We have Aristotle's will. And he has this phrase in it 2 or 3 times, which says, "All will be well." So he's kind of reconciled, I think, to what's come to pass.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Porter Greedy, and Neil Denny, and our guest this week is Mark Vernon. Mark, turning away from the ancients towards possibly some very modern and some very ancient things, you've recently edited the Chambers Dictionary of Beliefs and Religions, and this is the first edition for 20 years?
Yeah, I think it's about 20 years, yeah. A lot's changed in that time, and when I was asked to edit the dictionary, and I looked at the old dictionary, and it was clear, I think, then that religion had become quite a kind of niche interest. There's a lot of quite sort of niche theologians and niche issues in the old dictionary, whereas, of course, now you can barely open a newspaper without some story to do with religion. And moreover, the old dictionary was much to do with Christianity, and then a bit to do with other religions, but not a whole lot. Whereas, of course, now we're very conscious of living in a plural world, and where every day you bump into people who might think really very differently from you, especially in a city like London. So what we're trying to do with the dictionary is to reflect the modern world. We've bumped up the world religions. We've also introduced a whole load of stuff to do with unbelief, because that's obviously become a big part of the modern consciousness as well. And my hope is that the dictionary, in a way, it's kind of like a map of the world in which we live now. If you need to find out something about a sect or an argument or an issue, then that's in the dictionary. We have panels on contemporary issues and kind of guides to things and so on. So it's pretty interesting that in that period of time, just in the last 20-odd years, the world really has very dramatically changed. And not, I guess, in the way that people thought 20 years ago, because 20 years ago, lots of sociologists of religion were writing about secularism and how religion was basically just going to disappear. That clearly hasn't happened. So we've had to reflect that in the dictionary.
So the obvious question then is, why do you think that is?
Well, I guess it's because religions can thrive in the modern world, and the story that somehow the scientific mentality or more rational mentality would just sort of make... I don't think people thought there would be great combats then, but they just thought that religion would become uninteresting to people. It wouldn't really serve a purpose anymore. And that seems to not be the case, that people do turn to religion a lot. Now, whether it's a religion which you which you kind of feel comfortable with or not is another question entirely. What kind of religion is emerging in this modern world is another discussion. But, yeah, I guess that's what's really changed. Secularisation has become a different thing. It's become a turn to pluralism, I guess, rather than disappearance of religion.
Do you think that post kind of, well, what we can call kind of the, I suppose realistically, it's the end of socialism in 89, 90, and coupled with that, I mean, socialism as you know, a concept, look at this country, it is socialist, and also with greater kind of ease of communication and movement, we've come to define ourselves more by belief than any other criteria than, say, class or nationality.
I think that must vary enormously, actually, from place to place. There certainly are parts of the world where religion has become very closely associated with a national identity. Mm-hmm. So South Korea is probably the most well-known example. In South Korea, the Bible was translated into Korean, and rather like what happened when the King James Bible came out in the UK or in England, it's kind of led to this, it sort of spurned this revival of Korean culture more generally. So Christianity is now hugely popular in South Korea. So that's kind of one on the one hand. On the other hand, I guess, like the situation would be more in this country, religion is something which people take or leave. For some people it's very important. For most people it's probably not that important, although maybe at various points in life they'll turn to it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are people who for whom religion is the bane of our existence as well, you know, the kind of equal and opposite, I guess. So it varies hugely, I think. And if you just look at your neighbourhood, you're probably not going to get it right. the global picture is much, much more diverse.
I mean, I still find it interesting the way people have, since, you know, I've been in Britain 11 years now, but having come from a country where religion was part of everyday life in Ireland, and, you know, you didn't really know people who weren't, not weren't religious, but didn't have experience of religion. I still find it very kind of odd to come here and have people who not only have different religions, but just have never really encountered it in any sense at all.
Yeah, I mean, you now have English teachers saying that people need to be taught the Bible in English classes because otherwise they won't understand Shakespeare. I'm sure there's a kind of whole swathe of our culture that has lost contact with that kind of that inherited Christianity at a cultural level, let alone as a sort of faith level.
Yeah, but do you think that maybe the idea that, you know, I think people often get criticised for, you know, and often it's done in very pernicious ways, and like Britain is kind of defined as essentially a Judeo-Christian society. Is that dangerous, or is it just a fact that we have to kind of deal with?
It's a debate. It depends what people mean by that. I mean, some people say, we should hold on to our Christian identity because they want a kind of active Christianity to be asserted again in public life in some way. Other people reject our Christian identity because they see that as a retrogressive step. You know, it's kind of like a past they'd rather forget. I mean, I think that probably European culture is enormously shaped by Judeo-Christianity. And I think a lot of our ideas about secularisation, you know, funnily enough, actually come from that history. And the idea that you might separate church and state, you know, emerges after the Reformation. Originally it was a kind of religious movement, or religious move at least. So personally I think that it's a bit silly to either pretend that the world is other than it is in terms of wanting to everyone to start going to church again, or just to kind of say that Christianity's got nothing to do with us. You're kind of cutting yourself off in both ways.
Without wanting to get into a discussion of admin and stuff, I'd be interested to know what's actually involved in editing this. So it's I haven't brought it with me tonight because it's too heavy to carry along. It's a big chunky book, and it must have taken a huge amount of work to bring it together. Even though, presumably, a good section of it already existed because it's a new edition. So what is actually involved in editing a new edition?
Well, there is, like, the logistics. I must say that it's a Chambers dictionary, and Chambers dictionaries are their business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Robert McCrum in The Observer, he says that Chambers are the gold standard of dictionaries. Now, that's very nice for the reader of the dictionary, can kind of trust it, but it also means that they've got teams of people who know how to put dictionaries together, purely at a logistical level. Mm-hmm. And so for me as the editor, I can say that Chambers were a joy to work with. I basically had just had to make editorial decisions.
Yeah.
Now, that means I did have to read the whole thing. I did have to, you know, two or three times. I did have to be in touch with the writers. There's a whole team of writers, people with expertise in all sorts of areas. And there's a kind of editorial control in the sense of trying to be consistent in terms of style mm-hmm. as well, and have a vision of who the audience is. So the audience is the generally interested reader. It's neither, you know, like a full-on academic book for specialists, nor is it, you know, kind of intended for, I don't know, you know, maybe for primary schools. Mm-hmm. You know, somewhere in between. It's someone who reads a newspaper, if you like. That's the kind of person I had in mind. So it was actually remarkably, it was a long process, but it was remarkably pain-free, in fact. and, you know, I'm rather interested in religion and belief and unbelief and philosophy and all these other things, so I certainly learned quite a lot doing it myself.
Yeah, so you've just been able to basically absorb yourself in it for
Yeah. And you have, there's wonderful words you learn there. Do you know what psychopomp means? Psychopomp is the bit of religions where you're escorted to the underworld or the afterlife by some kind of intermediary. You know, so in the ancient Roman world, it was Clairon carrying you across the Styx. That was part of psychopomp. And I never knew what psychopomp was before.
Before we end, I want to go back to Plato's podcasts, and I want to talk about one more example. And this is Hypatia of Alexander, and this is somebody who will be very familiar to listeners of this show who have seen Carl Sagan's Cosmos, because there's a large section where there's a reconstruction and he tells the story. And Hypatia is someone who has become something of a secular saint for sceptics and rationalists, I think. So tell us the story of Hypatia, Mark.
Yeah, so Hypatia was... She's a very remarkable woman in the ancient world, because she was the head of Plato's Academy in Alexandria and was very well known. The stories are that, you know, her lectures drew massive crowds, that she was kind of adulated as she worked for the streets and so on. But she fell foul of particularly one of the Christian bishops of Alexandria. So she lived in the time when Christianity had become the kind of official religion of the Roman Empire, but it ran alongside pagan traditions and ancient Greek philosophical traditions as well. Now, the reason why we know about Hypatia at all is because she had chronicler, a Christian chronicler, told her story, and also one of her kind of closest friends was another Christian bishop. So it's a complicated situation, but there's no doubt about the fact that she met this really foul end at the hands of a kind of mob which was stirred up by the Bishop of Alexandria. And this has become a kind of gone down in the annals of early Christianity as the new religion kind of at its worst. And, you know, she met a sticky end, there's no doubt about it. And so in the book, I take her as emblematic of someone who holds to principles and tries to speak words of peace, I guess, even though she lives in very violent times.
There's become quite a... You've already alluded to the complications of the sort of situation that was going on. It's become perhaps a black and white story describing that this is an indication of the beginning of the Dark Ages almost, you know, that all of that knowledge of the Library of Alexandria was lost. But, well, it is more complicated than that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and pagan philosophy continued in Alexandria for at least another century after Hypatia. So the idea, I think Gibbons in his Decline and Fall, you know, wrote up Hypatia in a particular way, and we tend to... Carl Sagan certainly, I think, draws pretty much directly on that. Historians today would say it's a lot more complicated, and there were Christian philosophers working with pagan philosophers, you know, for at least another 100 years or so. Plato's Academy was finally shut in Athens in 529 AD, which was sometime after Hypatia. So maybe that's a marker for the end of the old pagan world and the Christian empire finally seizing control.
One has to give them sort of credit for their imagination, though, in that she was basically flayed alive with oyster shells and then torn limb from limb and burnt. And
the texts are slightly ambiguous, but one way of interpreting it is to say she was flayed alive. It wasn't a pleasant end. And, you know, this bishop had kind of black shirt mob. In fact, I mean, what happened was that the Christian bishop, fell into a confrontation with the kind of Christian civic ruler of Alexandria. So there was a kind of scrapping for power and for authority. And the emperor told this bishop to get rid of his crack squad. So the emperor too, who was Christian, felt threatened by this bishop. Now, I don't know quite where the modern analogy would be. There's kind of these rabid bishops with their black shirts and their crack squads and so on.
Perhaps we should leave it there. I just want to do another quick announcement. Sorry, Mark, thank you very much for joining us again.
Pleasure, nice to speak to you. Cheers.
And I'm just going to make another quick announcement about the Battle of Ideas, which is tomorrow and Sunday, the 31st and the 31st of October and the 1st of November. I presume there are still tickets. It's at the Royal College of Arts in London, features 75 debates and 300 speakers confronting society's big issues and unresolved questions on everything from the global economy to energy supply and video games to music education. And as I mentioned last week, there's numerous Little Atoms previous guests: David Aronovich, Claire Fox, Kenan Malik, Philip LeGrain, Frank Faridi, Ray Tallis, and Padraig and I will be there wandering around, so come and say hello. So, again, Mark, thanks very much for joining us again, and you've been listening to Little Atoms, and we'll see you next week.